Solomon, and later in life he changed his long Polish name to Maimon. When he was young, he found that the Talmud couldn't satisfy his hunger for knowledge. His mind wouldn't let him rest. He wanted to know what was happening in the outside world. German was by then a great scientific and cultural language, and he decided to teach himself to read German. But even after he learned German, he wasn't satisfied, because the reading of secular books was forbidden. Finally, at the age of 25, he abandoned his wife and child, and after many hardships, came to Berlin, where he joined a group of philosophers, read Aristotle, Maimonides, Spinoza, Leibniz, Hume, and Kant, and began to write philosophical books. It's astonishing how he was able to gobble up complicated philosophical treatises with such ease. He had a great mind, but it never left him in peace. He wandered from city to city, never finding roots anywhere, never satisfied, and finally died at 47 on the estate of a kind-hearted Christian who had befriended him. Reuven, Reb Saunders' son, has a mind like Solomon Maimon's, perhaps even a greater mind. And Reb Saunders' son doesn't live in Poland. America is free. There are no walls here to hold back the Jews. Is it so strange, then, that he's breaking his father's rules and reading forbidden books? He cannot help himself. It is unbelievable what he has read these past few months. You are a brilliant student, I tell you that now very proudly. But he is a phenomenon. Once in a generation is a mind like that born. Now, Reuven, listen very carefully to what I'm going to tell you. Reb Saunders' son is a terribly torn and lonely boy. There is literally no one in the world he can talk to. He needs a friend. The accident with the baseball has bound him to you, and he has already sensed in you someone he can talk to without fear. I'm very proud of you for that. He would never have told you about his library visits if he believed for a moment you wouldn't keep his words a secret trust. And I want you to let him be your friend, and to let yourself be his friend. I'm certain you and Reb Saunders' son can help each other in such a friendship. I know you, and I know him. And I know what I'm saying. And now, Reuven, the lecture is over. I'm going to finish my tea, and we will go to bed. What a lecture it has been. Do you want some tea? No, Abba. We sat in silence while my father sipped from his glass. You're very quiet, he said finally. It all started with a silly baseball game, I said. I can't believe it. Reuven, as you grow older, you'll discover that the most important things that will happen to you will often come as a result of silly things, as you call them. Ordinary things is a better expression. That is the way the world is. I shook my head. I just can't believe it, I said again. This whole week has been like something from another world. The hospital, the people I met there, Mr. Savo, little Mickey, Billy, all because of a ball game. My father sipped his tea and looked at me over the rim of the glass. He said nothing, but he was watching me intently. I don't understand it, I said. Weeks and weeks go by, one Shabbat follows another, and I'm the same. Nothing has changed. And suddenly, one day, something happens, and everything looks different. Different? What do you mean, different? I told him how I had felt that afternoon when I had come home from the hospital. He listened quietly, all the while sipping his tea. When I finished, I saw him smile. He put down the glass, sighed, and said, Reuven, it is a tragedy your mother is not alive to. He stopped, his voice breaking. He was quiet for a moment. Then he looked at the clock on the shelf over the refrigerator. It's very late, he said. We will talk some more tomorrow. Yes, Abba. Reuven. Yes? Never mind. Go to sleep. I'm going to sit here for a while and have another glass of tea." I left him, sitting at the kitchen table, staring down at the white cloth. Chapter 7. The next day, I met Danny's father. My father and I woke early so as to be in our synagogue by 8:30. Manya came in a little before 8 and served us a light breakfast. Then my father and I started out on the 3-block walk to the synagogue. It was a beautiful day, and I felt happy to be out on the street again. It was wonderful to be outside that hospital, looking at the people and watching the traffic. When it didn't rain and wasn't too cold, my father and I always enjoyed our Shabbat walks to and from the synagogue. There were many synagogues in Williamsburg. Each Hasidic sect had its own house of worship. Shtiblach, they were called. Most of them badly lighted, musty rooms with benches or chairs crowded together and with windows that seemed always to be closed. There were also those synagogues in which Jews who were not Hasidim worshipped. The synagogue where my father and I prayed had once been a large grocery store. It stood on Lee Avenue, and though the bottom half of its window was curtained off, the sun shone in through the uncurtained portion of the glass, and I loved to sit there on a Shabbat morning with the gold of the sun on the leaves of my prayer book and pray. The synagogue was attended mostly by men like my father, teachers from my yeshiva, and others who had come under the influence of the Jewish Enlightenment in Europe, and whose distaste for Hasidism was intense and outspoken. Many of the students in the yeshiva I attended prayed there too, and it was good to be able to be with them on a Shabbat morning. When my father and I came into the synagogue that morning, the service had just begun. We took our usual seats a few rows up from the window and joined in the prayers. I saw Davy Cantor come in. He nodded to me, looking gloomy behind his glasses, and took a seat. The prayers went slowly. The man at the podium had a fine voice and waited until each portion of the service had been completed by everyone, before he began to chant. I glanced at my father during the silent devotion. He stood in his long prayer shawl, its silver trim bathed in sunlight, its fringes dangling almost to the floor. His eyes were closed. He always prayed from memory, except during a festival or a high holiday service. And he was swaying slightly back and forth, his lips murmuring the words. I didn't wear a prayer shawl. They were worn only by adults who were or had once been married. During the Torah service, which followed the silent devotion, I was one of the 8 men called up to the podium to recite the blessing over the Torah. Standing at the podium, I listened carefully to the reader as he chanted the words from the scroll. When he was done, I recited the second blessing and the prayer that thanks God when a serious accident has been avoided. As I left the podium and walked back to my seat, I wondered what blessing, if any, I would have recited had my eye been blinded. What blessing would Mr. Savo make if he were a Jew? I asked myself. For the rest of the service, I thought constantly of Mr. Savo and Billy. Lunch was ready for us when we got home, and Manya kept adding food to my plate and urging me to eat. Food was necessary for someone who had just come back from the hospital, she told me in her broken English. My father talked about my work at school. I must be careful not to read until Dr. Snydman gave me his permission, he said, but there was nothing wrong if I attended classes and listened. Perhaps he could help me study. Perhaps he could read to me. We would try it and see. After the grace, my father lay down on his bed to rest for a while, and I sat on the porch and stared at the sunlight on the flowers and the ailanthus. I sat like that for about an hour, and then my father came out to tell me he was going over to see one of his colleagues. I lay back on the lounge chair and stared up at the sky. It was a deep blue with no clouds, and I felt I could almost touch it. It's the color of Danny's eyes, I thought. It's as blue as Danny's eyes. What color are Billy's eyes? I asked myself. I think they're also blue. Both Danny's and Billy's eyes are blue, but one set of eyes is blind. Maybe they're not blind anymore, I thought. Maybe both sets of eyes are okay now. I fell asleep, thinking about Danny's and Billy's eyes. It was a light, dreamless sleep, a kind of half-sleep that refreshes but doesn't shut off the world completely. I felt the warm wind and smelled newly cut grass, and a bird perched on a branch of the ailanthus and sang for a long time before it flew away. Somehow I knew where that bird was, though I didn't open my eyes. There were children playing on the street, and once a dog barked, and a car's brakes screeched. Someone was playing a piano nearby, and the music drifted slowly in and out of my mind like the ebb and flow of ocean surf. I almost recognized the melody, but I couldn't be sure. It slipped like a cool and silken wind from my grasp. I heard a door open and close, and there were footsteps against wood, and then silence. And I knew someone had come onto the porch, but I wouldn't open my eyes. I didn't want to lose that twilight sleep, with its odors and sounds and whispered flow of music. Someone was on the porch looking at me. I felt him looking at me. I felt him slowly push away the sleep, and finally, I opened my eyes, and there was Danny, standing at the foot of the lounge chair, with his arms folded across his chest, clicking his tongue and shaking his head. "You sleep like a baby," he said. "I feel guilty waking you." I yawned, stretched, and sat up on the edge of the lounge chair. "That was delicious," I added, yawning again. "What time is it?" "It's after 5, sleepyhead. I've been waiting here 10 minutes for you to wake up."
"I slept almost 3 hours," I said. "That was some sleep."
He clicked his tongue again and shook his head.
"What kind of infield is that?"
He was imitating Mr. Galanter.
"How can we keep that infield solid if you're asleep there, Malter?"
I laughed and got to my feet.
"Where do you want to go?"
he asked.
"I don't care.
I thought we'd go over to my father's shul. He wants to meet you."
"Where is it?"
I asked him.
"It's 5 blocks from here."
"Is my father inside?"
"I didn't see him."
"Your maid let me in."
"Don't you want to go?"
"Sure,"
I said.
"Let me wash up and put a tie and jacket on. I don't have a caftan, you know."
He grinned at me. "The uniform is a requirement for members of the fold only," he said.
"Okay, member of the fold. Come on inside with me."
I washed, dressed, told Manya that when my father came in she should let him know where I had gone, and we went out.
"What does your father want to see me about?"
I asked Danny as we went down the stone stairway of the house.
"He wants to meet you. I told him we were friends."
We turned up the street, heading toward Lee Avenue.
"He always has to approve of my friends," Danny said, "especially if they're outside the fold. Do you mind my telling him that we're friends?"
"No."
"Because I really think we are," Danny said.
I didn't say anything. We walked to the corner, then turned right on Lee Avenue. The street was busy with traffic and crowded with people. I wondered what any of my classmates would think if they saw me walking with Danny. It would become quite a topic of conversation in the neighborhood. Well, they would see me with him sooner or later. Danny was looking at me, his sculptured face wearing a serious expression.
"Don't you have any brothers or sisters?" he asked.
"No, my mother died soon after I was born."
"I'm sorry to hear that.
How about you?"
"I have a brother and a sister. My sister's 14 and my brother is 8. I'm going on 16.
"So am I,"
I said.
We discovered that we had been born in the same year, 2 days apart.
"You've been living 5 blocks away from me all these years, and I never knew who you were," I said.
"We stick pretty close together. My father doesn't like us to mix with outsiders."
"I hope you don't mind my saying this, but your father sounds like a tyrant." Danny didn't disagree.
"He's a very strong-willed person. When he makes up his mind about something, that's it. Finished."
"Doesn't he object to your going around with an apikoros like me?"
That's why he wants to meet you.
I thought you said your father never talks to you.
He doesn't, except when we study Talmud.
But he did this time.
I got up enough courage to tell him about you, and he said to bring you over today.
That's the longest sentence he said to me in years, except for the time I had to convince him to let us have a ball team.
I'd hate to have my father not talk to me.
It isn't pleasant, Danny said very quietly. But he's a great man. You'll see when you meet him.
Is your brother going to be a rabbi too?
Danny gave me a queer look.
Why do you ask that?
No special reason.
Is he?
I don't know.
Probably he will.
His voice had a strange, almost wistful quality to it. I decided not to press the point. He went back to talking about his father.
He's really a great man, my father. He saved his community. He brought them all over to America after the First World War.
I never heard about that, I told him.
That's right, he said, and told me about his father's early years in Russia. I listened in growing astonishment.
Danny's grandfather had been a well-known Hasidic rabbi in a small town in southern Russia, and his father had been the second of two sons. The firstborn son had been in line to inherit his father's rabbinic position, but during a period of study in Odessa, he suddenly vanished. Some said he had been murdered by Cossacks. For a time, there was even a rumor that he had been converted to Christianity and had gone to live in France. The second son was ordained at the age of 17, and by the time he was 20, had achieved an awesome reputation as a Talmudist. When his father died, he automatically inherited the position of rabbinic leadership. He was 21 years old at the time. He remained the rabbi of his community throughout the years of Russia's participation in the First World War. 1 week before the Bolshevist Revolution, in the autumn of 1917, his young wife bore him a second child, a son. 2 months later, his wife, his son, and his 18-month-old daughter were shot to death by a band of marauding Cossacks, one of the many bandit gangs that roamed through Russia during the period of chaos that followed the revolution. He himself was left for dead, with a pistol bullet in his chest and a saber wound in his pelvis. He lay unconscious for half a day near the bodies of his wife and children, and then the Russian peasant who tended the stove in the synagogue and swept its floor found him and carried him to his hut, where he extracted the bullet, bathed the wounds, and tied him to the bed so he wouldn't fall out during the days and nights he shivered and screamed with the fever and delirium that followed. The synagogue had been burned to the ground. Its ark was a gutted mass of charred wood. Its four Torah scrolls were seared black. Its holy books were piles of gray ash blown about by the wind. Of the 118 Jewish families in the community, only 43 survived. When it was discovered that the rabbi wasn't dead, but was being cared for by the Russian peasant, he was brought into the still intact home of a Jewish family and nursed back to health. He spent the winter recovering from his wounds. During that winter, the Bolshevists signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with Germany, and Russia withdrew from the war. The chaos inside the country intensified, and the village was raided 4 times by Cossacks. But each of those times, the Jews were warned by friendly peasants and were concealed in the woods or in huts. In the spring, the rabbi announced to his people that they were done with Russia. Russia was Esav and Edom, the land of Satan and the angel of death. They would travel together to America and rebuild their community. 8 days later, they left. They bribed and bargained their way through Russia, Austria, France, Belgium, and England. 5 months later, they arrived in New York City. At Ellis Island, the rabbi was asked his name, and he gave it as Senders. On the official forms, Senders became Saunders. After the customary period of quarantine, they were permitted to leave the island, and Jewish welfare workers helped them settle in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn. 3 years later, the rabbi married once again, and in 1929, 2 days before the stock market crash,
Danny was born in the Brooklyn Memorial Hospital. 18 months later, his sister was born, and 5.5 years after the birth of his sister, his brother was born, by cesarean section, both in that same hospital.
"They all followed him?" I asked. "Just like that?"
"Of course. They would have followed him anywhere."
"I don't understand that. I didn't know a rabbi had that kind of power."
"He's more than a rabbi," Danny said. "He's a tzaddik." "My father told me about Hasidism last night. He said it was a fine idea until some of the tzaddikim began to take advantage of their followers. He wasn't very complimentary."
"It depends upon your point of view," Danny said quietly.
"I can't understand how Jews can follow another human being so blindly."
"He's not just another human being."
"Is he like God?"
"Something like that."
"He's a kind of messenger of God. A bridge between his followers and God."
"I don't understand it. It almost sounds like Catholicism."
"That's the way it is," Danny said, "whether you understand it or not."
"I'm not offending you or anything. I just want to be honest."
"I want you to be honest," Danny said. We walked on in silence. A block beyond the synagogue where my father and I prayed, we made a right turn into a narrow street crowded with brownstones and sycamores. It was a duplicate of the street on which I lived, but a good deal older and less neatly kept. Many of the houses were unkempt, and there were very few hydrangea bushes or morning glories on the front lawns. The sycamores formed a solid, tangled bower that kept out the sunlight. The stone banisters on the outside stairways were chipped, their surfaces blotched with dirt, and the edges of the stone steps were round and smooth from years of use. Cats scrambled through the garbage cans that stood in front of some of the houses, and the sidewalks were strewn with old newspapers, ice cream and candy wrappers, worn cardboard cartons, and torn paper bags. Women in long-sleeved dresses with kerchiefs covering their heads, many with infants in their arms, others heavily pregnant, sat on the stone steps of the stairways, talking loudly in Yiddish. The street throbbed with the noise of playing children, who seemed in constant motion, dodging around cars, racing up and down steps, chasing after cats, climbing trees, balancing themselves as they tried walking on top of the banisters, pursuing one another in furious games of tag, all with their fringes and earlocks dancing wildly in the air and trailing out behind them. We were walking quickly now under the dark ceiling of sycamores, and a tall, heavily built man in a black beard and black caftan came alongside me, bumped me roughly to avoid running into a woman, and passed me without a word. The liquid streams of racing children, the noisy chatter of long-sleeved women, the worn buildings and blotched banisters, the garbage cans and the scrambling cats, all gave me the feeling of having slid silently across a strange threshold, and for a long moment I regretted having let Danny take me into his world. We were approaching a group of about 30 black caftan men who were standing in front of the 3-story brownstone at the end of the street. They formed a solid wall, and I didn't want to push through them, so I slowed my steps. But Danny took my arm with one hand and tapped his other hand upon the shoulder of a man on the outer rim of the crowd. The man turned, pivoting the upper portion of his body. A middle-aged man, his dark beard streaked with gray, his thick brows edging into a frown of annoyance, and I saw his eyes go wide. He bowed slightly and pushed back, and a whisper went through the crowd like a wind, and it parted, and Danny and I walked through, Danny holding me by the arm and nodding his head at the greetings in Yiddish that came in quiet murmurs from the people he passed. It was as if a black-waved, frozen sea had been sliced by a scythe, forming black, solid walls along a gelled path. I saw black and gray-bearded heads bow toward Danny and dark brows arch sharply over eyes that stared questions at me and at the way Danny was holding me by the arm. We were almost halfway through the crowd now, walking slowly together, Danny's fingers on the part of my arm just over the elbow. I felt myself naked and fragile, an intruder, and my eyes, searching for anything but the bearded faces to look at, settled finally upon the sidewalk at my feet. Then, because I wanted something other than the murmured greetings in Yiddish to listen to, I began to hear, distinctly, the tapping sounds of Danny's metal-capped shoes against the cement pavement. It seemed a sharp, unnaturally loud sound, and my ears fixed on it, and I could hear it clearly as we went along. I listened to it intently, the soft scrape of the shoe and the sharp tap-tap of the metal caps, as we went up the stone steps of the stairway that led into the brownstone, in front of which the crowd stood. The caps tapped against the stone of the steps, then against the stone of the top landing in front of the double door, and I remembered the old man I often saw walking along Lee Avenue, moving carefully through the busy street and tapping his metal-capped cane, which served him for the eyes he had lost in a First World War trench during a German gas attack. The hallway of the brownstone was crowded with black-caftan men, and there was suddenly a path there, too, and more murmured greetings and questioning eyes. And then Danny and I went through a door that stood open to our right, and we were in the synagogue. It was a large room and looked to be the exact size of the apartment in which my father and I lived. What was my father's bedroom was here, the section of the synagogue that contained the ark, the eternal light, an eight-branched candelabrum, a small podium to the right of the ark, and a large podium about 10 feet in front of the ark. The two podiums and the ark were covered with red velvet. What was our kitchen, hallway, bathroom, my bedroom, my father's study, and our front room was here, the portion of the synagogue where the worshippers sat. Each seat consisted of a chair set before a stand with a sloping top, the bottom edge of which was braced with a jutting strip of wood, to prevent what was on the stand from sliding to the floor. The seats extended back to about 20 feet from the rear wall of the synagogue, the wall opposite the ark. A small portion of the synagogue near the upper door of the hallway had been curtained off with white cheesecloth. This was the women's section. It contained a few rows of wooden chairs. The remaining section of the synagogue, the section without chairs, was crowded with long tables and benches. Through the middle of the synagogue ran a narrow aisle that ended at the large podium. The walls were painted white. The wooden floor was a dark brown. The three rear windows were curtained in black velvet. The ceiling was white, and naked bulbs hung from it on dark wires, flooding the room with harsh light. We stood for a moment just inside the door near one of the tables. Men passed constantly in and out of the room. Some remained in the hallway to chat, others took seats. Some of the seats were occupied by men studying Talmud, reading from the Book of Psalms, or talking among themselves in Yiddish. The benches at the tables stood empty, and on the white cloths that covered the tables were paper cups, wooden forks and spoons, and paper plates filled with pickled herring and onion, lettuce, tomatoes, gefilte fish, Shabbat loaves, the braided bread called challah, tuna fish, salmon, and hard-boiled eggs. At the edge of the table near the window was a brown leather chair. On the table in front of the chair was a pitcher, a towel, a saucer, and a large plate covered with a Shabbat cloth, a white satin cloth with a Hebrew word for the Shabbat embroidered upon it in gold. A long serrated silver knife lay alongside the plate. A tall, heavy-set boy came in the door, nodded at Danny, then noticed me and stared. I recognized him immediately as Dov Shlomowitz, the player on Danny's team who had run into me at second base and knocked me down. He seemed about to say something to Danny, then changed his mind, turned stiffly, went up the narrow aisle and found a seat. Sitting in the seat, he glanced at us once over his shoulder, then opened a book on his stand and began to sway back and forth. I looked at Danny and managed what must have been a sick smile. "I feel like a cowboy surrounded by Indians," I told him in a whisper. Danny grinned at me reassuringly and let go of my arm. "You're in the holy halls," he said. "It takes getting used to." "That was like the parting of the Red Sea out there," I said. "How did you do it?" "I'm my father's son, remember? I'm the inheritor of the dynasty. Number one in our catechism. Treat the son as he would the father, because one day the son will be the father." "You sound like a meetin' a ged," I told him, managing another weak smile.
"No, I don't," he said.
"I sound like someone who reads too much."
"Come on, we sit up front. My father will be down soon."
"You live in this house?"
"We have the upper two floors. It's a fine arrangement. Come on, they're beginning to come in."
The crowd in the hallway and in front of the building had begun coming through the door. Danny and I went up the aisle. He led me to the front row of seats that stood at the right of the large podium and just behind the small podium. Danny sat down in the second seat, and I sat in the third. I assumed that the first seat was for his father. The crowd came in quickly, and the synagogue was soon filled with the sounds of shuffling shoes, scraping chairs, and loud voices talking Yiddish. I heard no English, only Yiddish. Sitting in the chair, I glanced over at Dov Shlomowitz and found him staring at me, his heavy face wearing an expression of surprise and hostility. And I suddenly realized that Danny was probably going to have as much trouble with his friends over our friendship as I would with mine. Maybe less, I thought. I'm not the son of a tzaddik. No one steps aside for me in a crowd. Dov Shlomowitz looked away, but I saw others in the crowded synagogue staring at me too, and I looked down at the worn prayer book on my stand, feeling exposed and naked again, and very alone. Two gray-bearded old men came over to Danny, and he got respectfully to his feet. They had had an argument over a passage of Talmud, they told him, each of them interpreting it in a different way, and they wondered who had been correct. They mentioned the passage, and Danny nodded, immediately identified the tractate and the page, then coldly and mechanically repeated the passage word for word, giving his interpretation of it, and quoting at the same time the interpretations of a number of medieval commentators, like the Meiri, the Rashba, and the Maharsha. The passage was a difficult one, he said, gesticulating with his hands as he spoke, the thumb of his right hand describing wide circles as he emphasized certain key points of interpretation, and both men had been correct. One hand unknowingly adopted the interpretation of the Meiri, the other of the Rashba. The men smiled and went away satisfied. Danny sat down.
"That's a tough passage," he said. "I can't make head or tail out of it. Your father would probably say the text was all wrong."
He was talking quietly and grinning broadly.
"I read some of your father's articles, sneaked them off my father's desk. The one of the passage in Kiddushin about the business with the king is very good. It's full of real apikorsishy stuff."
I nodded and tried another smile. My father had read that article to me before he had sent it off to his publisher. He had begun reading his articles to me during the past year and spent a lot of time explaining them. The noise in the synagogue had become very loud, almost a din, and the room seemed to throb and swell with the scraping chairs and the talking men. Some children were running up and down the aisle, laughing and shouting, and a number of younger men lounged near the door, talking loudly and gesticulating with their hands. I had the feeling for a moment I was in the carnival I had seen recently in a movie, with its pushing, shoving, noisy throng, and its shouting, arm-waving vendors and pitchmen. I sat quietly, staring down at the prayer book on my stand. I opened the book and turned to the afternoon service. Its pages were yellow and old, with ragged edges and worn corners. I sat there, staring at the first psalm of the service and thinking of the almost new prayer book I had held in my hands that morning. I felt Danny nudge me with his elbow and I looked up.
"My father's coming," he said.
His voice was quiet, and I thought, a little strained. The noise inside the synagogue ceased so abruptly that I felt its absence as one would a sudden lack of air. It stopped in swift waves, beginning at the rear of the synagogue and ending at the chairs near the podium. I heard no signal and no call for silence. It simply stopped, cut off, as if a door had slammed shut on a playroom filled with children. The silence that followed had a strange quality to it. Expectation, eagerness, love, awe. A man was coming slowly up the narrow aisle, followed by a child. He was a tall man, and he wore a black satin caftan and a fur-trimmed black hat. As he passed each row of seats, men rose, bowed slightly, and sat again. Some leaned over to touch him. He nodded his head at the murmur of greetings directed to him from the seats, and his long black beard moved back and forth against his chest, and his earlocks swayed. He walked slowly, his hands clasped behind his back, and as he came closer to me, I could see that the part of his face not hidden by the beard looked cut from stone, the nose sharp and pointed, the cheekbones ridged, the lips full, the brow like marble etched with lines, the sockets deep, the eyebrows thick with black hair, and separated by a single wedge like a furrow plowed into a naked field. The eyes dark, with pinpoints of white light playing in them, as they do in black stones in the sun. Danny's face mirrored his exactly, except for the hair and the color of the eyes. The child who followed him, holding on to the caftan with his right hand, was a delicate miniature of the man, with the same caftan, the same fur-trimmed hat, the same face, the same color hair, though beardless, and I realized he was Danny's brother. I glanced at Danny and saw him staring down at his stand, his face without expression. I saw the eyes of the congregants follow the man as he came slowly up the aisle, his hands clasped behind his back, his head nodding. And then I saw them on Danny and me as he came up to us. Danny rose quickly to his feet, and I followed, and we stood there, waiting, as the man's dark eyes moved across my face. I could feel them moving across my face like a hand, and fixed upon my left eye. I had a sudden vision of my father's gentle eyes behind their steel-rimmed spectacles, but it vanished swiftly, because Danny was introducing me to Reb Saunders. "This is Reuven Malter," he said quietly in Yiddish. Reb Saunders continued to stare at my left eye. I felt naked under his gaze, and he must have sensed my discomfort, because quite suddenly he offered me his hand. I raised my hand to take it, then realized, as my hand was going up, that he was not offering me his hand, but his fingers, and I held them for a moment. They were dry and limp, then let my hand drop.
"You are the son of David Malter?"
Reb Saunders asked me in Yiddish. His voice was deep and nasal, like Danny's, and the words came out almost like an accusation. I nodded my head. I had a moment of panic trying to decide whether to answer him in Yiddish or English. I wondered if he knew English. My Yiddish was very poor. I decided to answer in English.
"Your eye," Reb Saunders said in Yiddish. "It is healed?"
"It's fine," I said in English. My voice came out a little hoarse, and I swallowed. I glanced at the congregants. They were staring at us intently, in complete silence. Reb Saunders looked at me for a moment, and I saw the dark eyes blink, the lids going up and down like shades. When he spoke again, it was still in Yiddish.
"The doctor, the professor who operated, he said your eye is healed?"
"He wants to see me again in a few days, but he said the eye is fine." I saw his head nod slightly and the beard go up and down against his chest. The lights from the naked bulb on the ceiling gleamed off his satin caftan.
"Tell me, you know mathematics? My son tells me you are very good in mathematics."
I nodded.
"So, we will see. And you know Hebrew? A son of David Malter surely knows Hebrew."
I nodded again.
"We will see," Reb Saunders said.
I glanced out of the sides of my eyes and saw Danny looking down at the floor, his face expressionless. The child stood a little behind Reb Saunders and stared up at us, his mouth open.
"No," Reb Saunders said. "Later we will talk more. I want to know my son's friend, especially the son of David Malter."
Then he went past us and stood in front of the little podium, his back to the congregation, the little boy still holding on to his caftan. Danny and I sat down.
A whisper moved through the congregation, followed by the rustle of pages as prayer books were opened. An old gray-bearded man went up to the large podium, put on a prayer shawl, and started the service. The old man had a weak voice, and I could barely hear him over the prayers of the worshippers. Reb Saunders stood with his back to the congregation, swaying back and forth, occasionally clapping his hands together, and the child stood at his right, swaying too, in obvious imitation of his father. Throughout the entire service, Reb Saunders stood with his back to the congregation, sometimes raising his head toward the ceiling or raising his hands to cover his eyes. He turned only when the Torah was taken from the ark and read. The service ended with the Kaddish, and then Reb Saunders walked slowly back up the aisle, followed by the child, who was still clinging to his father's caftan. As the child passed me, I noticed his dark eyes were very large, and his face was deathly pale. Danny nudged me with his elbow and motioned with his head toward the rear of the synagogue. He rose, and the two of us followed Reb Saunders up the aisle. I could see the eyes of the congregants on my face, and then feel them on my back. I saw Reb Saunders go to the leather chair at the table near the end window and sit down. The child sat on the bench to his left. Danny led me to the table and sat on the bench to his father's right. He motioned me to sit down next to him, and I did. The congregants rose and came toward the rear of the synagogue. The silence was gone now, burst as abruptly as it had begun, and someone started chanting a tune and others took it up, clapping their hands in rhythm to the melody. They were filing out the door, probably to wash their hands, I thought, and soon they were coming back in and finding seats at the tables, the benches scraping loudly as they were moved back and forth. The singing had stopped. Our table filled rapidly, mostly with older men. Reb Saunders stood up, poured water over his hands from the pitcher, the water spilling into the saucer, then wiped his hands, removed the white satin cloth that covered the challah, said the blessing over bread, cut a section off the end of the challah, swallowed it, and sat down. Danny got to his feet, washed his hands, cut two slices from the challah, handed me one, took one for himself, made the blessing, ate, and sat. He passed the pitcher to me, and I repeated the ritual, but I remained seated. Then Danny cut the remainder of the challah into small pieces, gave a piece to his brother, and handed the plate to the old man sitting next to me. The pieces of challah disappeared swiftly, grabbed up by the men at the table. Reb Saunders put some salad and fish on his plate and ate a small piece of the fish, holding it in his fingers. A man from one of the other tables came over and took the plate. Danny filled another plate for his father. Reb Saunders ate slowly and in silence. I wasn't very hungry, but I made some attempt at eating so as not to insult anyone. Frequently during the meal, I felt rather than saw Reb Saunders' eyes on my face. Danny was quiet. His little brother pecked at the food on his plate, eating little. The skin of his face and hands was almost as white as the tablecloth, drawn tightly over the bones, and the veins showed like blue branches in his face and on the tops of his hands. He sat quietly, and once he began to pick his nose, saw his father look at him and stopped, his lower lip trembling a little. He bent over his plate and poked at a slice of tomato with a thin, stubby finger. Danny and I said nothing to each other throughout that entire meal. Once I looked up and saw his father staring at me, his eyes black beneath the thick brows. I looked away, feeling as though my skin had been peeled away and my insides photographed. Someone began to sing Atai Had, one of the prayers from the evening service. The meal was over, and the men began to sway slowly in unison with the melody. The singing filled the synagogue, and Reb Saunders sat back in his leather seat and sang too. And then Danny was singing. I knew the melody, and I joined in, hesitantly at first, then strongly, swaying back and forth. At the end of the song, another melody was begun, a light, fast, wordless tune sung to the syllables chiribim chiribam, and the swaying was a little faster now, and hands were clapped in time to the rhythm. Then tune followed tune, and I felt myself begin to relax as I continued to join the singing. I found that most of the melodies were familiar to me,
especially the slow, somber ones that were meant to convey the sadness of the singers over the conclusion of the Shabbat. And the tunes I didn't know, I was able to follow easily because the basic melody lines were almost all the same. After a while, I was singing loudly, swaying back and forth and clapping my hands, and once I saw Reb Saunders looking at me, and his lips curved into a shadow of a smile. I smiled at Danny, and he smiled back at me, and we sat there for about half an hour, singing, swaying, and clapping, and I felt light and happy and completely at ease. So far as I could see, Reb Saunders' little son was the only one of the synagogue not singing. He sat pecking at his food and poking at the slice of tomato on his paper plate with his thin, veined hand. The singing went on, and then it stopped. I glanced around to see what had happened, but everyone was sitting very still, looking over at our table. Reb Saunders washed his hands again, and others spilled what was left of the water in their paper cups over their hands. The introductory psalm to the grace was sung together, and then Reb Saunders began the grace. He chanted with his eyes closed, swaying slightly in his leather chair. After the opening lines of the grace, each man prayed quietly, and I saw Danny lean forward, put his elbows on the table, cover his eyes with his right hand, his lips whispering the words. Then the grace was done, and there was silence, a long, solid silence in which no one moved, and everyone waited, and I stared at Reb Saunders, who was sitting in his chair with his eyes closed, swaying slightly back and forth. I saw Danny take his elbows from the table and sit up straight. He stared down at his paper plate, his face expressionless, and I almost had the feeling that he had gone rigid, tense, as a soldier does before he jumps from shelter into open combat. Everyone waited, and no one moved, no one coughed, no one even took a deep breath. The silence became unreal and seemed suddenly filled with a noise of its own, the noise of a too long silence. Even the child was staring now at his father, his eyes like black stones against the naked whiteness of his veined face. And then Reb Saunders began to speak. He swayed back and forth in the leather chair, his eyes closed, his left hand in the crook of his right elbow, the fingers of his right hand stroking his black beard, and I could see everyone at the tables lean forward, eyes staring, mouths slightly open, some of the older men cupping their hands behind their ears to catch his words. He began in a low voice, the words coming out slowly in a sing-song kind of chant.
"The great and holy Rabban Gamaliel," he said, "taught us the following. Do his will as if it were thy will, that he may do thy will as if it were his will. Nullify thy will before his will, that he may nullify the will of others before thy will." What does this mean? It means that if we do as the master of the universe wishes, then he will do as we wish. A question immediately presents itself. What does it mean to say that the master of the universe will do what we wish? He is, after all, the master of the universe, the creator of heaven and earth, the king of kings. And what are we? Do we not say every day, "Are not all the mighty as naught before thee? The men of renown, as though they had not been? The wise, as if without knowledge? And the men of understanding, as if without discernment?" What are we, that the master of the universe should do our will?
Reb Saunders paused, and I saw two of the old men who were sitting at our table look at each other and nod. He swayed back and forth in his leather chair, his fingers stroking his beard, and continued to speak in a quiet sing-song voice.
"All men come into the world in the same way. We are born in pain. For it is written, 'In pain shall ye bring forth children.' We are born naked and without strength. Like dust are we born. Like dust can the child be blown about, Like dust is his life. Like dust is his strength. And like dust do many remain all their lives until they are put away in dust, in a place of worms and maggots. Will the master of the universe obey the will of the man whose life is dust? What is the great and holy Rabban Gamaliel teaching us?
His voice was beginning to rise now.
What is he telling us? What does it mean to say, the master of the universe will do our will? The will of men who remain dust? Impossible. The will of what men, then? We must say, the will of men who do not remain dust. But how can we raise ourselves above dust? Listen, listen to me, for this is a mighty thing the rabbis teach us.
He paused again, and I saw Danny glance at him, then stare down again at his paper plate.
Rabbi Halafta, son of Dosa, teaches us. When 10 people sit together and occupy themselves with the Torah, the presence of God abides among them. As it is said, God standeth in the congregation of the godly. And whence can it be shown that the same applies to 5? Because, it is said, he hath founded his band upon the earth. And whence can it be shown that the same applies to 3? Because, it is said, he judgeth among the judges. And whence can it be shown that the same applies to 2? Because it is said, then they that feared the Lord spake one with the other, and the Lord gave heed and heard. And whence can it be shown that the same applies even to 1? Because it is said, in every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. Listen, listen to this great teaching. A congregation is 10. It is nothing new that the Holy Presence resides among 10. A band is 5. It is also nothing new that the Holy Presence resides among 5. Judges are 3. If the Holy Presence did not reside among judges, there would be no justice in the world. So this too is not new. That the Presence can reside even among 2 is also not impossible to understand. But that the Presence can reside in one, that already is a mighty thing. Even in one. If one man studies Torah, the Presence is with him. If one man studies Torah, the Master of the Universe is already in the world. A mighty thing. And to bring the Master of the world into the world is also to raise oneself up from the dust. Torah raises us from the dust. Torah gives us strength. Torah clothes us. Torah brings the Presence.
The sing-song chant had died away. He was talking in a straight, loud voice that rang through the terrible silence in the synagogue.
But to study Torah is not such a simple thing. Torah is a task for all day and all night. It is a task filled with danger. Does not Rabbi Meir teach us? He who is walking by the way and studying and breaks off his study and says, how fine is that tree? How fine is that field? Him the scripture regards as if he had forfeited his life.
I saw Danny glance quickly at his father, then lower his eyes. His body sagged a little. A smile played on his lips, and I thought I even heard him sigh quietly.
He hath forfeited his life. His life! So great is the study of Torah! And now listen, listen to this word. Whose task is it to study Torah? Of whom does the Master of the Universe demand? Ye shall meditate over it day and night. Of the world? No. What does the world know of Torah? The world is Esav.
The world is a Malek. The world is Cossacks. The world is Hitler. May his name and memory be erased. Of whom then? Of the people of Israel. We are commanded to study his Torah. We are commanded to sit in the light of the presence. It is for this that we were created. Does not the great and holy Rabbi Yochanan, son of Zakkai, teach us? If thou hast learnt much Torah, ascribe not any merit to thyself, for thereunto wast thou created. Not the world, but the people of Israel. The people of Israel must study his Torah.
His voice stormed the silence. I found myself holding my breath, my heart thumping in my ears. I could not take my eyes off his face, which was alive now, or his eyes, which were open and filled with dark fire. He struck the table with his hand, and I felt myself go cold with fright. Danny was watching him now, too, and his little brother stared at him as though in a trance, his mouth open, his eyes glazed.
The world kills us. The world flays our skin from our bodies and throws us to the flames. The world laughs at Torah. And if it does not kill us, it tempts us, it misleads us, it contaminates us. It asks us to join in its ugliness, its impurities, its abominations. The world is a Malek. It is not the world that is commanded to study Torah, but the people of Israel. Listen, listen to this mighty teaching.
His voice was suddenly lower, quieter, intimate.
It is written, this world is like a vestibule before the world to come. Prepare thyself in the vestibule, that thou mayest enter into the hall. The meaning is clear. The vestibule is this world, and the hall is the world to come. Listen. In Gematria, the words this world come out 163, and the words the world to come out 154. The difference between this world and the world to comes out to 9. 9 is half of 18. 18 is chai, life. In this world, there is only half of chai. We are only half alive in this world. Only half alive.
A whisper went through the crowd at the tables, and I could see heads nod and lips smile. They had been waiting for this, apparently. The gematria. And they strained forward to listen. One of my teachers in school had told me about gematria. Each letter of the Hebrew alphabet